Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, it's our last episode before our summer break. Yeah. The podcast will continue. You'll be able to hear various live episodes that we've recorded in recent weeks and months.
Really good ones.
Yeah, but it's our show before we break up for our little break. And I have good news for you.
Yeah.
Before you got here this morning, I fixed the Japanese toilet.
Oh, my God.
So if you want to go and indulge yourself after we finish, there's a little pre-holiday treat for you.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That it's been out of action for sort of
18 months. Yeah, 20 months. And yeah, you'll be fresh as a daisy.
How did you manage to fix it?
I found the remote control and put some batteries in. I mean, there was no great mystery to it.
That's impressive. In a world that is kind of relatively chaotic, does restoring a sort of some order of sort of relatively minor things give you a sense of reassurance? Because it does with me, definitely.
Well, maybe we'll see. Maybe, you know, the my Japanese toilet working was the thing that was keeping the world intact. And by letting it go to rack and ruin 20 months ago.
You think things might turn around?
Maybe.
I've got a long list of things I have to do before I go on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it, sort of doing them will make me feel like the world is sort of more in control, even though it's like the world is quite out of control.
There's something psychologically interesting about that. If you can't control external events,
then you should control whatever the opposite of the meta is. What is the opposite of the meta? According to Dr. Google, mesa is the opposite. I don't think that's quite unmeta.
That's more like it.
Yeah.
That's more
Controlling the minor things means you feel less sort of kind of bad about the major things.
And while we're away on our summer break, you, the listener, will get to hear a 100th episode recorded at Abbey Road.
Happy birthday to us.
That's right, which we did last week. And
I
said I would.
Happy birthday, dear Ed and Jeff, and Reasons to be Cheerful. Happy birthday to us.
We're a jolly good fellows.
We're a jolly good podcast.
Yes. Yeah. So I didn't tell you about the awful thing that happened. So we were lucky enough to be hosted by Universal Music at Abbey Road Studios, and we were very excited.
Yeah.
And they arranged for Giles Martin to be one of our guests, who's son of George Martin, who's Mr. Abbey Road, really. We also had a fantastic, one of the sort of breakthrough acts of the last year, Rebecca Taylor from Self Esteem. And to close the show, a performance by Katie Tunstall.
Yeah.
So they really looked after us.
Yeah.
Before you arrived, I'm in the big studio two at Abbey Road, and I fairly much literally bump into Katie Tunstall, and somebody says, "Oh, this is Jeff." Now she hasn't got a clue what that means. She just thinks I'm here to do a podcast with Ed Miliband, who is this Jeff that I've never heard of. So instead of just explaining that, I make it a little bit worse, because in a former life I've interviewed her a couple of times. So I say, Oh, actually, we have met, I think. I think you were on my old radio show a couple of times playing in session. She then pretends to remember me, but she doesn't really remember me. And I try and make it better by saying, oh, I looked a bit different, my hair was longer. And then to try and rescue things and change the subject a bit, I said, I always loved it how whenever you come in to perform a session, you had your own microphone. Do you remember that Diamante microphone you used to have? And she looked at me, and then she just said, I think you'll find that was Amy McDonald, not me.
That is terrible.
I know.
That is really bad.
It's not great, is it?
What did you say?
I said, oh, well, there we go. One all then. One all. You didn't remember me. And I got you mixed up with Amy McDonald.
Making it even worse.
Yeah, well, I'm not good at the, you know, these type of interactions aren't my strong suit. Anyway, I left her to do her sound check in the studio. I went out into the corridor. I'm like, I'm sure. Have I made it up? Have I met Katie Tunstall? So I was Googling my own name and then Katie Tunstall next to it. And sure enough, there comes up on my phone pictures of me and Katie Tunstall in 2011. As I'm doing this, guess who comes over and looks over my shoulder?
Katie Tunstall.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was just excruciating.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it reflects very well on her.
Yeah.
That there's no evidence of any of that happening during the interview.
Yeah. The funny thing was about today is that I didn't necessarily feel the need to say hello to you because you didn't say goodbye to me on Sunday night.
So we did a live show in Clapham on Sunday night, and I didn't say goodbye.
Well, one minute I was with you, and it was like, should we get something to eat? And the next minute, you'd buggered off.
No, you said you didn't want to get anything to eat.
Well, I said it in a kind of...
I felt a little bit rejected because I keep making these social advances.
No.
You've decided our friendship is going to be a purely professional.
No, because your wife, Sarah, was like, I really want to go home. And I said, okay, fine, no, I'm happy to go home. And then I texted him, and he said... And I said, are you okay? Thinking he always gone off home. He said, oh, yeah, I'm in Pizza Express. And I was like, thanks for my fucking invite to Pizza Express.
You'd had an Ed Miliband themed sandwich at the venue. I thought you were full.
Ooh. Right, should we talk about what we're talking about?
We should.
We've got a fantastic conversation. We're talking to two great organisations that are working to bridge divides in communities and bring people together. And, you know, it's really interesting. Loneliness is an issue that affects older people, but there's also increasing evidence that it affects younger people as well. And our guests are overcoming that by bringing people together. So we're talking to Alex Smith, who's founder of the Cares Family, an organization that runs networks connecting young people with older people. And Ivo Gormley, who set up Good Gym, which encourages people to combine exercise, something I know you're enthusiastic about, with... basically doing good things for their benefit and the benefit of other people. And I think it's a really, really interesting concept.
I meant to ask about that too.
Yeah. And then we'll be talking to Emma and Joyce, who have been involved in Good Gym in Bristol. And honestly, it's a bit like the Parkrun episode, this. It will really inspire people, I think.
Yeah, and then we have a comedian called Joe Bohr, who's going to be telling us about his Edinburgh show and giving us ideas, which could be reasons to be cheerful.
Well, my reason to be cheerful is I'm obviously sad to be without you for a month, but I'm really looking forward to my holiday. I'm going to be in Vancouver.
The Groover from Vancouver.
Maybe I should call myself that. And we're going to, family and I are going to various islands and driving around and all that jazzaroo.
I was going to sort of pick what I'm doing with my holidays. It's not quite holidays for me, but time off at the podcast. So I'm going to Salford to do some work for the BBC, but for some of the time, I'll be in Edinburgh, where my wife is doing her second Edinburgh hour of stand-up this year at the Pleasance Upstairs. It's called Enemies Closer. And,
ooh, interesting. Last year, it was called For Worse.
Yes.
As in for better or worse.
Yes.
Or for worse. Enemies Closer.
Yes.
Interesting.
So I was just going to recommend that as part of my reason to be cheerful. She's called Sarah Barron. She's very funny.
She's absolutely brilliant.
She's on every
she's
evening.
Quite rude.
Yeah. It's not family friendly.
But it's good.
My friend saw it last night and he did a tweet saying it's not family friendly, especially not to her family. So it's called Enemies Closer and it's on the Pleasance Upstairs.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're joined now in the loft by Ivo Gormley, who is founder and chief executive of Good Gym, and Alex Smith, founder and chief executive of the Cares Family. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hey.
Alex, tell us about the Cares Family and what it is and how you came to be involved and start it. You started it, right?
Yeah. In 2011. But funnily enough, there's some symmetry in the relationship with Ed, because it goes back to general election day, May the 6th, 2010, which was the day before, I think, I started working with Ed Miliband on his then leadership election. And I myself was a council candidate in the area that I grew up in, North London, was doing my rounds, knocking on people's doors, trying to get people to come out and vote, and met an 84-year-old man behind one of the doors who said he'd love to come out and vote. He'd never missed an election in his life, but he wouldn't be able to on this day because he hadn't been out of his house for 3 months. He hadn't spoken to anyone for 3 months apart from his carer, who bought him his breakfast in the morning and his dinner at night. And there was a wheelchair behind him, so I cheekily suggested that if he was happy to and comfortable to, I would wheel him down the road. That's one extra vote, right? And you work for every vote. I'd wheel him down the road so that he could perform that democratic duty that he obviously so valued.
And did you offer to wheel him back up again once he'd voted?
Oh, yeah, I wasn't right. Just going to leave him there. No. He became animated while we were out. He was waving at people. He said it was lovely to be out on a very sunny day. If only he could get a haircut, because he felt in those 3 months he'd lost his dignity. In his own words. So having lost my election, my council election, the next day, I went back and visited Fred again and wheeled him down the road again, 5 minutes down the road to the barber shop in Holloway, where he sat and he had a haircut, and I got to know him a bit. And it turned out we had loads in common, mostly that he had set up and run the shop that was my favourite place growing up in Camden Town as a kid, Escapade, which I'm sure Ed will remember.
Yeah, party
fancy
shop.
Dress. Yeah, party and fancy dress shop. That was his shop. So I had met him 25 years earlier, but he'd fallen into isolation. I'd fallen into the kind of isolation of being indulged in your own little world of commuting to work with your iPhone headphones on and hanging out with other people who are just like you in front of a computer screen all day. And as well as Fred and I becoming friends, a light bulb went off in my head, and I thought there must be lots of older people like Fred with deep roots in their community, but very few connections, and lots of people like me, young people in their 20s and early 30s with hundreds of connections in the social media age, but no roots in their community necessarily. So founded North London Cares, and 8 years later, we have South London Cares, Manchester Cares, Liverpool Cares, and about to be East London Cares as well, which bring older and younger people together to share time, laughter, and new experiences.
And how are you doing that?
Four key programs. The first is called Love Your Neighbour, which are relationships just like mine and Fred's, where people hang out in one another's homes. They go out for coffees together. They go to football matches together. We give them a small budget to go to do whatever it is they want to do, or get a fish and chip supper in on a Friday night. The second program is called Social Clubs. Dance parties, new technology workshops, back to work business visits, desert island disc nights where people share their favorite records. Basically group activities where 20, 30, 40 older people and 20, 30, 40 younger people come together to share those experiences. Outreach, which is basically door knocking and speaking to people in supermarkets and at bus stops and in pubs and at betting shops and in chemists, basically where they are in the community where isolation can exist. And we bring older people in to the network that way, and we share stories online, which inspires and enables young people to get involved as well.
So lots to talk about there, which we're going to come back to. I just want to bring Ivo in at this point. Ivo, what is Good Gym, and tell us the story behind that?
Good Gym came from my own sort of needs, I suppose. I basically wasn't exercising. I used to play a lot of basketball when I was at university, and had come back to London and found myself not exercising. And after a few years, my friends were saying, you really should go to the gym. And I just didn't like that specific idea of going into a sweaty basement and paying loads of money to lift loads of things that don't really need lifting, and to run nowhere on a treadmill, and thought, what if I could put that same energy into doing something that
he's
was
a
actually
man after your
useful.
Own heart,
very much so, yeah.
So like, what would you, to literally give yourself a purpose for that exercise. And I think, you know, the treadmill's an amazing symbol of things going quite badly wrong. I mean, the Romans literally built cathedrals and bridges with treadmills. They achieved incredible work, and now they're like, it's this symbol of this isolation, that instead of doing something useful and productive and for the greater good, for thinking about the future, we actually just,
you're really putting me off the gym, Ivo. I think I'm going to cancel my membership. Yeah. I was actually thinking about this today.
Well, come for a good gym run. So instead, I started running to deliver the newspaper to a guy called Terry, who was similarly to what Alex's experiences with Fred, was very much on his own.
How did you know Terry?
He was my friend's parents' ex-builder, and we'd been past his house because my friend was like, this guy might like a visit, while we were walking by. And I thought, if I could drop in Tim. So I went to chat to him and said, how about I come and visit you once a week? And he said, well, it'd be really handy if you could bring me the Sun newspaper.
Did you try and talk him around to a different newspaper?
it wasn't my choice, and I didn't feel I should argue him. But the Sun it was. So, and it only cost 20p at the time. So it was sort of like I have one 20p piece in my pocket that didn't jangle. But every Tuesday and Thursday, I'd go around delivering the newspaper. And he didn't have any family or friends that visited him at all. And so I was the only person who wasn't paid to be visiting him. And over the years that I knew him, we became very good friends. And for me, it was that reason to go out and do some exercise. And what's so exciting about, I think, what the Cares family are doing and what I was doing is positioning this thing that I think neither of us really like talking about volunteering, because it sort of assumes like my life's sorted, I'm going to go and help those people who's really got problems. And I think what's so amazingly empowering about what we're doing is it just feels great. It feels good to be doing
something. And what kinds of things do people do? I mean, you started with Terry and taking a copy of the Sun, but yeah. What are the other what's the range of things?
So we do that. We match up runners with older people in that area who might need that extra support. But we also run to do manual labour for community projects. Last night I was in Wanstead with 15 other runners, and we were pulling ivy out of the trees to stop them being pulled down by the ivy. We help with schools, with playgrounds, with parks, anything that's manual labour for the good of the public, we turn it into a workout.
And how does it compare with a regular workout? So often when people are runners, they kind of get in a zone and it's quite solitary in a way. Do you get people who are serious about running?
I'm sort of in both camps these days. I used to be like, that is really pointless to run around the block. But since getting into it, I now can appreciate that sort of pleasure in the sort of getting into your own thoughts and that like meditative side of it. But I also love the social side. It was great last night meeting people who, you know, really don't run that much, and we're finding this a great way into it. I think if you generally want to be more physically active, then we're a fantastic solution to it. If you are a professional athlete or you're particularly wanting to build up your, you know, biceps to look good on the beach, whatever, then we're probably not for you.
I'm just squeezing Jeff's biceps.
I genuinely didn't know that was a bicep. I mean, that is how little I know.
It's going to encourage you to be more active, and it's going to encourage you to be healthy. It's also extremely good for your well-being, which I think is actually what many people are looking for. So I think actually it is definitely a viable alternative.
And you've got 15,000
runners.
And how often are they doing stuff for you?
We will have about 1,500 people a week actually doing a task every week.
They tend to be once a week, do they?
Quite a few people are like, do loads, and yeah, it's ridiculous the amount that they're doing, and there's a bit of a competition to see who can do the most in a month. But probably average is, you know, a couple of times a month. So and that's important to us. We want this to be easy. We'd love you to, you know, have a go and do it once. Find it easy to come in and out.
Definitely, you
know, people's lives are changing very rapidly.
I like, you know, I'd be up for a bit of
ivy pulling.
Pulling out the ivy. The running, yeah. I'm a bit more concerned.
No, that's
about.
Okay. We don't want to make you do anything you are not comfortable with. Can I just ask you both a question before we get on to some of the effects of all this? How do you go from I met Fred, I met Terry to thousands of people across different parts of the country? I mean, what's the sort of journey that take that?
I can only articulate the experience that I've had. I think Ivo will have had a different one, and anybody starting a community organization in their own community will have to do this differently. But what I would say is that if you have some big grand vision and a group of trustees or strategists sitting around and figuring out the best way to transform or end a social issue, you're never going to get anywhere. The way that we did it was absolutely the opposite. It was accidental. It was incremental. It snowballed. It started with just me, with no plan, no trustees, no money. I was also working full time doing other things in the first year, including for you, Ed, actually.
Yeah.
Bit by bit, I think I realized that this issue was fundamental, one of the fundamental issues at the heart of British society, which was pulling us apart. You just have to kind of go slow and incrementally and follow your nose a little bit and not think too much about the grand vision and what you're trying to achieve.
What's the process of matching people up? And then we'll hear from Ivo, but how easy or difficult is that?
We have spent months and months and months on 100-page risk assessments and different policies that help the younger people to be protected when they're going to visit an older person, that make big group settings with dynamics and wires and things moving around and dance parties, we've had to make sure that those environments are incredibly safe for people. But at the same time, we appreciate that interactions with strangers involves risk. And we don't want to completely eliminate that risk. I don't know either if it's the same.
And what does that look like? Like a Tinder, for example, would I log onto it and it'd show me that sort of 10 lonely people near me?
You would go to our website. You would sign up and come along to an induction. We would introduce you to the work that we do, why it's important, some of the stories of the older neighbours who are involved. We'd hopefully inspire you through an individual story and somebody that you could get to know one-to-one. Or you might just come along to a social club, a Desert Island Disc Night, where you bring your favourite records along and you share what those records mean to you. And some people in their 80s and 90s will share some records that might surprise you and tell you what those records mean to them.
What's the most popular of the activities you do, the one-to-one or the more
group? The group activities, because you can get more people into them. I think they're also more visible as well, and they're more dynamic, and it's, and we don't have to protect and safeguard them in the same way that we do a one-to-one relationship in somebody's home.
Ivo, how did you go from Terry to thousands?
It's keeping going, to some extent, is a huge part of these things happening, I think, and also being able to form an actual community. And I think fun is a major part of that. The part where I realized we're onto something here is actually when the group session started to be weekly. The group session started as like, oh, that could be quite good, we could get we as a way of getting around DBS checks. When the group runs became weekly, people started forming a community around it. It became part of the way that you sort of live your week. You'd see your friends there, you'd be excited about what that sort of adventure you were going to go on that night would be, and people started really enjoying it. And I think that's what's so important about this, I think, is that there is so much pleasure and excitement in being part of something like this. And I think what some of the problems that we're tackling is actually in day-to-day life these days, you're actually not given that many opportunities to contribute positively to the community or local sort of geography in which you live.
And what about the scale of loneliness that's out there? What have you learned about it?
I think for us, we've learned that it's something like 9 million people in the UK of all different ages are often or always lonely.
How do you quantify lonely? Just say to somebody, are you lonely? Yes, no. What's the way that you measure it?
Well, the difficult thing is that it's a very subjective experience. It is both an emotional problem and a public health problem and a political problem. The work that we do doesn't seek to label a lonely hearts club for lonely people. I think that's the sort of thing that nobody's going to come to.
Right.
So we've definitely very intentionally act as an organization which is trying to be preventative and, as Ivo says, fun, and create a community and a network around people who are most at risk of loneliness, which includes people living in social housing, people who are retired, and, by the way, younger people and young professionals in particular in big cities. One of the things that I always think is that while it may seem to somebody who's living a life in their 20s and 30s that they have a glamorous life because they're working in big city firms or they're going to a wedding at the weekend or they're hanging out in the pub or they're going to the gym, that actually the currency that they derive from that is in some ways less valuable than the currency that you derive from human interactions, re-raising your empathy. If you're a management consultant and you come along and, you know, you're at a wedding on a Saturday and people ask, what do you do, as their first question? It used to be, how do you do? And now, you know, if you sit with a 90-year-old man or woman who's got a lifetime full of stories of love and loss and hope and heartbreak and misadventure to tell, and you tell them you're a management consultant, that's going to have no currency with them. So you have to re-raise your empathy, your sense of humor, your kindness, your flirtation, your silliness, something that's going to make people respond in a really human way.
The big change, I think, in our thinking about loneliness in the last year has been from this the BBC research that said that it was actually younger people, 16 to 24-year-olds, 40%. Are saying that they're always or often lonely. That's twice as much as the over 75s. So basically this whole thinking about this has flipped around.
That's amazing.
And in my head, yeah, it's absolutely massive finding that we have this idea still of that sort of lonely older person looking out from behind the net curtains, who is, you know, on their own and sad. And to some extent, the sort of the archetypes that me and Alex have talked about in Fred and Terry. But actually, it's that younger generation who feels like they need more of that contact. And I think that just goes into this whole thing of it being very important for us not to think of this thing of volunteers and beneficiaries.
Right.
And actually, we're only a tiny moment away from being the beneficiary. And at some point, you know, it's a fluid experience. It's so empowering to actually be that person providing that help, and that works both ways. Which
and
is
are,
why...
are you getting a sense of that in terms of the feedback you get from the people who volunteer?
It was a matter this morning. I read a tweet from one of our runners saying, "I visited my good gym coach. We call the older people coaches because they're providing that motivation to run 99 times. I couldn't recommend the experience enough. Once a week, I spend an hour or so with an elderly lady I'm proud to call my friend, my surrogate grandma. Enriching for both of us."
Amazing.
There was a guy called Sam, and I think it's that two-way thing, which grandparents is just such an amazing sort of model for it to some extent, and the way that actually have always in many cultures played an extremely important role in bringing up kids in families, and now as we live more mobile lives, we don't live near our grandparents. So I think largely what Alex and I are trying to do is reconstruct some of those structures that have existed for a long time that just make it easy for you to, like, you know, catch up with someone.
I mean, that does seem to me to be really important, because if it's like do-gooding by the younger person, it feels like a chore, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think volunteering in this country is wonderful and has an important role to play, but the powers that be overvalue some of that volunteering because it's you know, it's structured, it's organized, it's easier to measure than the volunteering that's not even through an organization like ours, which says that you're just picking up a pint of milk for an older neighbor, or you're taking your neighbor's kids to school. I think if we can find some way to measure the value of that, whether in our GDP or through government or through one of the amazing foundations in this country, that's really important. Ultimately, what we're getting at is not merely loneliness. That's the problem that we're trying to solve. But actually, if you flip that and you think optimistically about what we could achieve if we writ this movement large, which I think we're on the cusp of doing, by the way, is a sense of belonging, particularly in a rapidly changing world, particularly in rapidly changing cities and communities which are affected by globalization, gentrification, housing bubbles, digitization, the transience that Ivo's talking about, that actually you will find that people feel that they can put down roots through the relationships that they hold in their local community.
You're both working on a younger, older people's model, correct? More or less. Is that right?
More or less.
I mean, presumably this could be about other divides that exist in our society.
Absolutely. And I think
class, faith, whatever.
The stitching in society is coming apart because of the lack of association, whether to trade unions or political parties or your local scouts group or football or the things that gave people identity, which are now unaffordable for people to go and stamp their identity on something and have those relationships with people who mean something to them, which means that, you know, one in four mums feels lonely often or always. Suicide is the biggest killer of men under the age of 45 in this country. There is a mental health crisis. There is a loneliness crisis. But as I was saying before, that's not just because people are disconnected from their wider communities. It's also because they're disconnected from themselves and this feeling of being part of something bigger. So I completely agree. And some of the work that the Cares family is doing over the next 12, 24 months is to see whether our model of mutual interactions that mean something to both parties across perceived divides can be applied to educational inequalities, class inequalities, racial divides, ethnic divides, religious divides, north-south divides, the filter bubbles that we get from this dominance of technology in our lives, and to try and get people to overlook some of those perceived divides and come together because, as Michelle Obama says, you can't hate up close.
What's the biggest barrier to entry for people in both cases of your thing, do you find?
For us, I'd say it's time and access. People will say it's too, I haven't got time, I'm too busy. People also, and provision also, in most of our sessions are full. We have in every area, we'll have one group session a week, and we're pretty much at capacity for those. So we need to find ways to be able to put more of them on. I mean, like a gym that's open 24 hours, that's where we need to get to. We need to make it that easy for you to turn up that, you know, in 20 minutes time, you've got something just down the road that you can get involved in.
And, you know, in the Cares family, I think similarly to Ivo, some of the barriers to making this stuff happen are actually the reasons that we do it. People are living such seemingly busy lives that they think that they don't have time or they're too tired after work, and they find that some other community organizations may be too bureaucratic or they can't relate to them. So again, you have to lower the barrier to entry and make it easy for people to get involved. Ultimately, the biggest barrier in my experience is actually British culture. this thing that, you know, we prioritize what's efficient over what's important. We have this kind of Northern European individualist society in parts of Southern Europe, Africa, Asia, South America. They don't have this same problem where they don't have relationships with people who are not like them or from different generations. So I think we need to look at the kind of buttoned up, stiff upper lip of and keep calm, carry on British culture, and realize that we need to create public spaces for people to interact on their own terms organically as well as through organizations like ours.
What's the scale of your ambition and sort of how, but not just what you're both doing, how do you scale this up?
I think there's a strong need for it to happen in some way. We're going to be in a world, I think, very soon where most people don't need to work. I was listening to Harari, the author of Sapiens, and I think for the first time we have a dominant sort of ideology that says actually people are not that important to the future of the world. And I think that, you know, we're going to get close to that. A lot of us will have this, a lot of free time, and it's our choice now to decide what we want that to look like. So I think it's extremely important that we do work to elevate that sense of human connection and contribution through projects like this, but also others. I mean, in terms of our ambition, I think it's absolutely needed. We would like to operate in every city in the world. We're getting to the stage where we're, you know, every city in the UK. But yeah, there's still a long way to go.
You're
going to
go beyond the UK, are you? Is one step you?
I hope so. I think in the next year or so, we will have been fully established in the UK on a sort of sustainable basis. It would then make sense to look further afield.
We want to help as many individual people as possible in their own communities feel as connected as possible. And yet that leads you to a question of scale of your organization, which I don't think ultimately is going to solve this problem. So I think there are policy things and systemic things that government and local authorities can do. And actually this government has already created the loneliness minister, and there are objectives within this government.
Do you feel they're doing a good job with it?
I think that in putting it front and center, they have raised a question which leads us on to the next question, which is ultimately about British culture change. And that's the thing I think we ultimately need to do. I don't want to skip to the end and the Jeffocracy, but what I would do
Let's skip to the end. So what would you do if you were minister for, would it be minister for loneliness? What would you like to
be? There is already a minister for loneliness. So what I would
say, the new broom is going to sweep clean in that Jeffocracy.
I think that the disconnection that we're experiencing in our ostensibly connected age that has created Brexit as a symptom of that disconnection. Brexit is not a cause of that disconnection. It's only, you know, the tip of the iceberg. What I would do would be, once the legal Brexit is accomplished, whether it's accomplished, we don't know, but once it's accomplished, I would shift all of the money that's in the Department for Leaving the European Union and create an institute or a Department of Connection that not only did lots of research on how to reduce loneliness, how to build communities, particularly in the fastest changing communities, but that also created pilots all over the country in some of the places that are most affected by loneliness. And again, not just across generational divides, but across class divides, race divides, ethnic divides, all the different divides that there are, and make sure that this was a number one priority. And I would partly do that by creating a new national narrative that connects our disconnection in this connected age back all the way to the history of the British Empire, slavery, because until we have that discussion about the way that British power and wealth has amassed in certain places and therefore created powerlessness as well, until we have that conversation, I don't think we can have a fully inclusive country.
Have we got an episode for you coming up soon?
Ivo?
The issues that we're looking at are affecting cities at least across the Western countries. In terms of policy, I think I would be encouraging any public service or government funded service to be building in some opportunities for mutual aid of some kind. So I think the example that I was thinking was, I had a baby 2 years ago, and I did the NCT baby classes that you pay quite a lot of money for, and I did the NHS ones which are free. And the only real difference between those two things was that the NCT ones basically forced you to set up a WhatsApp group with those people, and to start using it while you're in it. And so that starts building these connections and these opportunities for the parents at a time of need to help each other out. And that, and because it's expensive, that's only middle class people, and is quite exclusive. And the NHS ones give you the information, then go home. There was no expectation that there was that connection would be established. So I would put into everyone bidding for any public sector contract, potentially even outside, that they need to build in those opportunities for mutual aid, because it's those tiny things, even things like that people help you up the stairs in the tube station with the buggy, that people like light each other's cigarettes, which is not very healthy, but those tiny things where it's permissible to ask a stranger for that help, they establish trust, they establish the basis of community, and that community is the basis of belonging, happiness, and all of those other things that we really need.
Our listeners are raring to go for both Good Jim and Cares. Tell them what they need to do, or they can do.
Well, if you live in North London, South London, Manchester, Liverpool, or East London, you can go to the websites northlondoncares.org.uk, etc., or you can visit the overall caresfamily.org.uk website. Also, what you can do is get in touch with us, because if you don't have a Cares Family branch in your local community, we're looking at ways to spark this movement, and we want to be able to support you to do this in your own way, in your own community. So if you get in touch with me on Twitter or elsewhere, then let's see if we can help
you. And what are you on Twitter?
AlexSmith1982.
And for Good Jim, it's really easy to get involved. You don't have to run. There are sessions every week all across the country. If you go to goodjim.org, you should be able to find a session that suits you. Walking, running, it's very easy to get involved, and everything we do is free.
I'm incredibly inspired. Even you're inspired.
Definitely, I'm pulling out some ivy.
Good. Alex and Ivo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
All right, well, to bring what we've been talking about to life and give you an example of it in action, we're going to speak to Emma and Joyce, who are a runner and a coach, in inverted commas, involved in Good Jim in Bristol. We have Emma first. Emma, hello. Tell us about how you got involved in Good Jim.
Hi, I got involved in Good Jim because I moved to Bristol a couple of years ago, and I'd heard about how inspiring it was to do Good Jim from my brother who lives in Sheffield, and so I thought it'd be a good way to get to know people, get to know the city, but really just get involved in something that was Bristol based.
And what's interesting there is, I think often when people think about these things, they think about the older person perhaps being the one who's not connected, but you were a stranger in the city, and it gave you a way of forging links.
Yeah, exactly. I actually started doing some of the group runs that Good Jim does, and I didn't know much about the coach runs at the time, but then other people told me about them, and actually I thought that was a really good match for me, a way to get to know someone that knows the city really well. They've lived here for a long time and has a really different perspective on things. Yeah, meeting Joyce every week is, it's a really nice part of my day as well, because I do it. I go in my lunch hour on my work from home day. It's something really nice for me to do.
How far do you run, Emma, to see her?
It's not very impressive, actually. I run for about 15 minutes.
Okay. That is impressive
it's
to me,
that honestly.
That's 14 minutes and 50 seconds more than Jeff runs for.
Yeah.
And has it been quite motivating for you?
Hugely motivated, because otherwise I wouldn't run anywhere. It makes you run because you're going to see someone, and that's your chance each week to catch up with them. And if you don't get out there and run, you're not going to see them for a while. And also hopefully it's a nice part of Joyce's day where we're catching up on things, having interesting conversation. If you're feeling lazy, it just gives you that extra push out the door to get outside.
And tell us about the nature of your interaction with Joyce. I mean, what have you got out of it?
Well, Joyce is an incredibly interesting woman, and she's 96.
Amazing.
For me, I know, and she's so smart and she's lived an incredible life. And she's really switched on. So I learn a lot just talking to her about, what's going on in the world. And she's incredibly knowledgeable about books and music and art. And she's, we've read some, poetry together. And she talks to me about all of her travels that she's done over the years, which is just incredible. And for me, I don't have any other older people in my life, really. So it's nice to have someone who's lived for that long and you know, can talk about all these incredible experiences that she's had and you know, her life during wartime and what Bristol's been like over the last few decades. So it's been really interesting for me to find out all about that side of things.
And what would you say to people who are listening to this who, like, they're considering getting involved in Good Gym, but they're perhaps a little bit apprehensive about it?
I would say just go for it, because I think it's really well organised. And at any point, you only do as much as you want to do. And I think actually you'll probably discover things and people that you wouldn't have normally done. And you do get, you know, there's exercise involved as well. So it does actually help you keep fit.
I think you're pushing Jeff over the edge into doing this.
Yeah, you should. I'm really evangelical about it.
It sounds great. Emma, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So I'm delighted to say, having talked to Emma, we're now joined by Joyce on the line from Bristol. Joyce, thank you so much for joining us.
I've been looking forward to it.
Fantastic. Tell us a little bit about your friendship with Emma.
Well, she came to me as somebody, a volunteer, who would come and perhaps make my life more interesting. I've no family in Bristol. I'm Welsh, so I like talking.
Right.
So it was welcomed. When she started coming, it soon became very obvious to both of us that we enjoyed each other's company and what we were telling each other and how we were reacting to each other. I enjoy talking and hearing and perhaps providing some of the young with some things they don't know about the past and how it was, particularly for women.
And how about in the other direction? What do you learn from Emma, from talking to Emma?
Well, Emma and I really talk about books. She works for a publisher. And I've always been a bookworm. And now, because I can't read anymore, I have macula and I can't read. I talk about books I've read and she talks about books she's read and books we'd like to read, you know. And you can talk a lot about books to each other if you're both bookworms.
And we're talking in our episode this week about projects like the one that's brought you and Emma together. Do you think we need more organisations doing this kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
You feel it's got real, has had real benefits for you?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's a lot of pleasure in my life because there's so many things I can't do anymore that I used to do. And it's just such a pleasure to have somebody like Emma who really understands.
Well, Joyce, it's been brilliant to talk to you and really, really inspiring. And Jeff and I are really grateful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And more power to your elbows, both of you.
Thank you.
So what did you think?
Well, I mean, it just sounds great, doesn't it? I can sometimes be a bit sceptical about things where it seems like people are picking up the slack of what government should be doing.
Yeah.
And I know people will have different opinions on that depending where you are on the political spectrum. But I mean, there are policy things, as Ivo pointed out. But by and large, I mean, it just sounds like a good thing. And I think I would like to get involved.
Wow.
In having people come to my house and do things for me.
But maybe you'd like to read. Maybe, I mean, I was thinking about whether we should make some kind of pledge.
I pledge that if a runner wants to come here and do the washing up, the dishwasher's broken at the moment.
Maybe we should do one Good Gym thing in the next 12 months.
12 to 18 months, definitely.
12 to 18 months.
Yes. Next couple of years, we'll definitely do one. I'll definitely go for a run in 2 years' time.
I think it's really inspiring. You know what? I think it taps into it. I think people want to be part of something bigger than themselves, and they want connection and belonging, which is what both Alex and Ivo were saying. And I think these kind of ideas, and I actually found Ivo and Alex used to work for me, you know, incredibly inspiring, because you know, there they were, they met Terry and Fred, and they could have just said, oh, well, it's been nice to Terry and Fred or whatever. But they had the insight and they thought we can make a huge difference. And when Ivo was talking about getting these emails, getting these reports on what was actually happening, you can see why for both of them, I mean, they are making a real difference and all of the people involved with it. And also I thought Joyce and Emma were just absolutely brilliant.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Let us know your thoughts on this week's episode. Have you been inspired to volunteer? Have you got experience in volunteering? You can email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter or Instagram at cheerfulpodcast, or go to facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast. Now, this is an interesting email. This is from Anna, who says, Dear Ed and Jeff, since listening to you, I have felt inspired to join Extinction Rebellion, do parkrun, and organise two litter picks.
Wow.
She says, I've got my husband listening to you too, and we often sit around the dinner table agreeing with each other about the state of the world while our son throws his food on the floor. He is 36. My idea for a reason to be cheerful is the Olympic Games. Andrew Zimblist is an economist who has contrasted the unrealistic claims of the benefits to the host city with the economic cost of hosting the Games, the unaccountability of the IOC, people being removed from their homes to make way for venues, host cities being left with facilities they don't need. People talk about intangible effects like national pride or the inspiring effect of seeing elite athletes competing, but I don't buy that, as their performance level is just too unattainable. So my idea for improving the Olympics, she adds in brackets, Jeff is going to hate this, I actually love this.
Oh, I'm on tenterhooks. This is like the cliffhanger. Yeah?
It's good, this. Is to have competitors randomly selected from the population, sortition style. I envision a sort of cross between the Generation Game and the Hunger Games. That sounds far more interesting to me.
Yeah.
They could be selected to the team 3 years in advance to be given access to professional coaches and facilities. It'd inspire people more. And as they would see non-athletes like them competing, the Strictly effect, it would motivate government to fund grassroots sport and motivate people to maintain a high level of fit. See, you have lost me, I'll be honest, because the way I was envisaging it is there's no training.
Yeah,
you just get picked the week before, and then
you
have to do it.
That would be quite embarrassing. Then you'd be in a stadium of 80,000 people,
yes,
sort of limping.
Do you not think that would be
around
more
the 5,000 meters?
For me, that would be more interesting.
What if it
to
was
watch
you that was picked?
That would, but I think, you know, I look at some of the people on the street, and I'm mainly talking about children. But I do think I could beat some of them in a race.
I think you need training. I think she's right about that.
Yeah. Anyway.
I wonder if they did that in Greek or Roman times.
I wonder.
There must have been something like that going on.
It's a great idea. She adds, P.S. I love Gentleman Jack, which we were talking about, but you could have warned me about all the deaths and injuries. Sorry, Anna.
There you go. This one comes from Tiger Stone. No relation to Tiger Woods. Hi, Ed and Jeff.
I don't think it tends to work like that.
It doesn't, no. Just checking you're listening. I've just been listening to the most recent podcast about trees. It has implored me to make you aware of holistic grazing. Basically, it's a farming technique which involves moving livestock in a way that mimics the predation of large groups of herbivores, meaning the livestock generally stays in a more compact formation. I'm telling you this because it's been found the soil which has supported holistically managed cattle can absorb one third more CO2 than the cattle produce. Actually, somebody told me about something very similar yesterday. Although it's not entirely related to trees, I thought it would be worth mentioning as something to go alongside tree planting. If you're interested in this topic, I highly recommend Cows Save the Planet by Judith Schwartz, which inspired me to do an environmental science degree, and The City Forest by Pierre Yeomans, which is a lot more tree-focused, so perhaps a little more idealistic in places. Anyway, I really love the podcast and happily bow down to Jeff as supreme leader and one true God. I mean, I'm practically sort of choking as I get this out. Hugs and kisses, Tiger Stone.
I mean, you pick a role in the Jeffocracy, Tiger. And also on this, on last week's episode, this has the subject line, Reasons Not to Garden. It comes from Matthew Oliver, who says, I have a surprisingly large and unkempt garden in South London, which I am too lazy to keep nice. It's full of weeds, wild flowers, fruit trees, and all sorts of prickly things. It's also teeming with wildlife, including bees, butterflies, bugs, and is even home to London's apex predators, the cat and the fox. I am regularly scolded by my enthusiastic gardener parents for letting nature take over my plot of land. Yet now, thanks to you, I have been vindicated with the knowledge that I am, in fact, the owner of an effective carbon sink and therefore a reason not to garden. I hope other non-gardeners like me have been similarly inspired to keep their tools in the shed.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet at Cheerful Podcast.
And joining us now with some ideas, comedian Joe Bohr. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. This is the second time Joe and I have met in recent weeks because I interviewed Joe on Radio 5 Live. And your Edinburgh show, it sounds fantastic. Ed, you tuned in and you heard all about it,
definitely,
did you?
Definitely.
So can you praise you for every... Because I know, you know, as a supportive friend, you would be listening to me on the radio.
Yeah.
Can you praise you for everybody what Joe's show is about?
I mean, it's just so rich and textured, Joe's show, that it's just almost impossible to summarise, don't you think, Joe? I mean, you've actually got to be... You've got to be in it to win it. You've got to be there to really get the full flavour of
really
it.
Amazing.
Spot the politician. Yeah. Spot the politician. Ducking the questions.
It's quite something, isn't it? So for people like Ed who don't know, can you tell us what the show is?
I mean, it sounds pretty serious. It's called Joe Bohr, The Story of Walter and Herbert. And it's about my granddad and his best friend, who was a famous actor, Herbert Lom.
Herbert Lom,
You know Herbert Lom. Basically, it's about their friendship. They lived in Prague, and Herbert helped my granddad escape during the Holocaust.
Wow.
And it's an amazing story. I can say that because it's not my story. It's my granddad's story.
Herbert Lom was in the Pink Panther film.
Yeah. And they were each other's best men, and they both became very successful. My granddad got a CBE for architecture.
Your granddad had an extraordinary life, sort of shaping a lot of modern architecture and modern cities.
Yeah, he designed Milton Keynes.
What was his name?
Walter Bohr.
Right.
He was also a town planner for Prague and Liverpool and a lot of other places. He was a very funny guy and found the humour in it all, even though, you know, he went through quite a lot. And their friendship was quite funny. They were very competitive, like most friends, and I sort of talk about that. Yeah, in the show. Come along.
We don't want to give too many spoilers away. But yeah, it's great. A great story to make into a show.
Yeah, it's a lot of research. I've never had to research a show before. Normally, I just put in.
Is it harder or easier than just writing jokes?
It's very hard. It's just a lot of. I would have spent the day sort of reading and rather than writing. But then it's very rewarding. I feel like I'm doing something a bit more worthwhile than just.
And how did you first come across the story?
I don't know. I hadn't done Edinburgh for a while, and then I sort of realised that I found these letters that they'd written to each other, actually, and they'd written a declaration of success. They'd written, you know, this thing together that I found of them talking about how they wanted to be a success in I think it was like 1939 or something, and it was really inspiring. And I thought there's something in this.
Sounds great. Everyone should go along.
Yes, on at the Underbelly.
Underbelly at 4 o'clock, yeah.
Great. And you've brought some ideas for us today.
Yes.
What's the first one?
I'd like to see body diversity on Love Island. More hairy men, basically. as a hairy man, myself. I think just
do you feel marginalised as a hirsute gentleman?
I feel underrepresented.
You don't see a hairy back very often on television, do you?
No, no. There's not, you know, I've got a hairy chest, and you just don't even see that. They're shaving a lot.
Ed is completely smooth like an action man.
That's quite true. What is this Love Island thing anyway?
You know, stuff like that. Yeah,
don't watch it.
Do you know what's it? Yeah. But there's these.
Jeff and I have had disagreements in the past.
Well, I was really into it last year, and I even bought Ed a Love Island themed water bottle, which he smashed up.
Accidentally.
But I haven't watched it this year because I sort of said to my wife, look, I will watch it, but not if it's the TV main course. It can be the starter or it can be the dessert, but it can't be our TV main course.
I mean, wonder people have like body image problems in the country.
Maybe like a dad bod version. Love Dad Bod Island.
Because they're going to do it twice a year now, so they're going to...
No.
Yeah, they're going to do two series a year, so hopefully...
And also, I think you could be in with a chance for that.
You know, I'm married.
No, the dad bod.
Oh, I've definitely got the dad bod, yeah.
Yeah, I'd just like to see more of that, I think.
All right, we'll have that. What's your next one, Joe?
I think we should do something about people who try and make other people drink alcohol.
Right.
I do drink it, but I'm not a massive sort of alcohol drinker, and I'll be in the pub and I'll want to order a soft drink and my friends will be like, no. I'm a food person. I don't sort of go up to my friends and sort of force them to eat food and go, no, you have to have some.
But do you not do that thing where you say, oh, you've got to try this? I mean, just
yeah,
have a bite.
Maybe I do. Yeah. Maybe I do. Yeah.
Not quite in the same way with drink. Drink is different.
Yeah.
I think we're on for this.
Yeah.
Hairy Love Island. No drink shaming.
Two for two.
No drinking pressure.
Drinking pressure.
We're not abolitionists.
I think stealing jokes should be illegal. I wrote a joke in 2013 and it was in the kind of best jokes of the fringe lists.
What is it? I'm afraid this is a big build up, Joe. What's the joke?
I know. Well, the joke is my wife told me sex is better on holiday, which is not a nice postcard to receive. Yeah.
So that doesn't seem... I mean, that seems like it would be your joke. But often, you know, I will see people on Twitter saying, oh, such and such has stolen my joke. And you just think it's a pretty commonplace idea that two people could have gotten to independently of each other. And you've got six followers. So how would they have overseen it in the first place?
I should just let it go and write new jokes.
And I just feel like most times it's happened, you just give people the benefit of the doubt, because like especially people who are doing it professionally, the worst thing you can be labeled as is a thief. So why would somebody be going around stealing something when it potentially would be damaging to their careers? Also, I think ideas, there's loads of them, you know.
I mean, speaking personally, that's what I did when Theresa May stole the Energy Price Cap. I just thought she had the same idea. Just coincidentally, 3 years later, she had the same idea.
And do you have one last idea, Joe?
Introduce financial incentives for getting fit.
How much will you pay me to come to Park Run with you then, Ed? I mean, this is...
No. But I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I try and be healthy, but I sort of struggle. And then a friend of mine sort of said, let's £50 if we meet our goal. Or if we don't meet our goal, we give each other money. And it's sort of having that in my head actually makes me want to be more fit. It hasn't quite worked yet.
Because once you do it, you're kind of... I'm so... Parkrun has been the revelation of this year for me.
So I was in Sweden recently, went to see a friend whose weight goes up and down. Him and his friends decided they were going to get in... They wanted to
get fit,
lose some weight. And so he talked to a doctor and said, how much is a healthy amount to lose? And the doctor said, 10% of your body weight over the course of 4 months. So they decide they're going to do this, but they don't want to make it a competition about who loses the most weight, because then it's like somebody might go nuts with it and whatever. But they do feel there needs to be some kind of forfeit if you don't hit 10% of your body weight. So they come up with this idea that whoever doesn't hit the 10% has to donate the equivalent of £100 to the Sweden Democrats, which is like the far right party in
that's
Sweden.
Great.
And then they
that's
have to screen grab it and send it to the others. And then they can put it on social media as a way of shaming them. So it's like his incentive to hit this target is to not give money to the far right.
That's dangerous. Is this how Boris Johnson
feels? It feels like a reckless gamble. What happened?
Well, they're still in the competition, but I think they're all on course to lose 10% of the body weight.
I'm not sure I'd recommend this.
No, it's a high-risk strategy,
feels
isn't
a bit
it?
Russian roulette.
Yeah, yes, it does a bit. All right, Joe, the show is on at the Underbelly in Edinburgh.
Yes, at 4 p.m. Yes, the story of Walter and Herbert.
Yeah, great.
Sounds brilliant.
Thank you. Come on.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're in the outro.
Here we are.
I know, and it's
our
gonna
last
be
outro.
I know,
our
my hankies are gonna come out. But before we go, I do want to mention,
speaking of hankies coming out,
yes,
we ordered food to be delivered during the podcast today.
And Joe.
And Joe, who works with us, very kindly went downstairs to get some cutlery. Ed said, can you get some paper towel? I said, oh, I haven't got any, but maybe you could bring up a couple of tea towels. And Joe somehow has found two of my hankies. I mean, where were you rummaging to find those, Joe?
I'm now waving it above my head.
You should tie little knots in it and put it on your head on your holiday.
Talking of Joe, who's a brilliant person, his partner, Sarah, runs an absolutely fantastic organisation, which I want to give a shout out for, called the Kids Network. And basically, it's mentoring for 8 to 11-year-olds. They operate in London. It's honestly tremendous. I went to a dinner the other night, which was a fundraiser for them. And you know, they are making the mentors. It's quite intensive mentoring once a week. But the mentors are making an absolutely massive difference to the lives of kids from sometimes quite difficult backgrounds. And it's a brilliant charity. And you can find out more about it on my social media, or it's the Kids Network. So I'd like to thank Alex Smith, Ivo Gormley, and Joyce and Emma.
And Joe Bohr. Go see his show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Emma Caution produces our podcast with backup and research from Joel Pierce and Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed composed the music. James Deacon made the idents, and the artwork was made by
Emily Power.
So that's it. Yeah, you've got live episodes all summer long, and there's some cracking ones, including in a couple of weeks, episode 100 at Abbey Road.
Written Constitution, Abbey Road, How to Tackle the Climate Emergency, Empire.
There's
honestly, just
lots to get your teeth into.
All fantastic, fantastic episodes, and we will see you in September. Meanwhile, he's been to Pizza Express.
He wasn't invited.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.